Welcome to The Bookshelf. I'm Chris Massini. We're returning tonight to the story of Daisy Buchanan, Jay Gatsby, and Nick Carraway in The Great Gatsby by F. Scott Fitzgerald. Nick has been learning more and more about his rich and mysterious neighbor and his cousin, Daisy. When we last left off, Daisy's friend, Jordan Baker, was telling Nick the story of Daisy's wedding to Tom Buchanan. Here's Tom Lee, reading The Great Gatsby.
I was bridesmaid. I came into her room half an hour before the bridal dinner and found her lying on her bed as lovely as the June night in her flowered dress, and as drunk as a monkey. She had a bottle of Sauterne in one hand and a letter in the other. "Gratulate me," she muttered. "Never had a drink before, but oh, how I enjoy it." "What's the matter, Daisy?" "I was scared, I can tell you. I'd never seen a girl like that before." "Here, dearest." She groped around in a wastebasket she had with her on the bed and pulled out the string of pearls. "Take 'em downstairs and give 'em back to whoever they belong to. Tell 'em all Daisy's change her mind. Say, Daisy's change her mind." She began to cry. She cried and cried. I rushed out and found her mother's maid, and we locked the door and got her into a cold bath. She wouldn't let go of the letter. She took it into the tub with her and squeezed it up into a wet ball, and only let me leave it in the soap dish when she saw that it was coming to pieces like snow. But she didn't say another word. We gave her spirits of ammonia and put ice on her forehead and hooked her back into her dress, and half an hour later, when we walked out of the room, the pearls were around her neck and the incident was over. Next day at 5 o'clock, she married Tom Buchanan without so much as a shiver and started off on a 3 months trip to the South Seas. I saw them in Santa Barbara when they came back, and I thought I'd never seen a girl so mad about her husband. If he left the room for a minute, she'd look around uneasily and say, "Where's Tom gone?" and wear the most abstracted expression until she saw him coming in the door. She used to sit on the sand with his head in her lap by the hour, rubbing her fingers over his eyes and looking at him with unfathomable delight. It was touching to see them together. It made you laugh in a hushed, fascinated way. That was in August. A week after I left Santa Barbara, Tom ran into a wagon on the Ventura Road one night and ripped a front wheel off his car. The girl who was with him got into the papers, too, because her arm was broken, and she was one of the chambermaids in the Santa Barbara Hotel. The next April, Daisy had her little girl, and they went to France for a year. I saw them one spring in Cannes, and later in Deauville, and then they came back to Chicago to settle down. Daisy was popular in Chicago, as you know. They moved with a fast crowd, all of them young and rich and wild, but she came out with an absolutely perfect reputation, perhaps because she doesn't drink. It's a great advantage not to drink among hard-drinking people. You can hold your tongue, and, moreover, you can time any little irregularity of your own so that everybody else is so blind that they don't see or care. Perhaps Daisy never went in for amour at all, and yet there's something in that voice of hers. Well, about 6 weeks ago, she heard the name Gatsby for the first time in years. It was when I asked you, do you remember, if you knew Gatsby and West Egg? After you had gone home, she came into my room and woke me up and said, "What Gatsby?" And when I described him, I was half asleep, she said in the strangest voice that it must be the man she used to know. It wasn't until then that I connected this Gatsby with the officer in her white car. When Jordan Baker had finished telling all this, we had left the plaza for half an hour and were driving in a Victoria through Central Park. The sun had gone down behind the tall apartments of the movie stars in the West 50s, and the clear voices of girls, already gathered like crickets on the grass, rose through the hot twilight. "I'm the Sheikh of Araby. Your love belongs to me. At night when you are asleep, into your tent I'll creep." "It was a strange coincidence," I said, "but it wasn't a coincidence at all." "Why not?" "Gatsby bought that house so that Daisy would be just across the bay." then it had not been merely the stars to which he had aspired on that June night. He came alive to me, delivered suddenly from the womb of his purposeless splendor. "He wants to know," continued Jordan, "if you'll invite Daisy to your house some afternoon, and then let him come over." The modesty of the demand shook me. He had waited 5 years and bought a mansion where he dispensed starlight to casual moths, so that he could come over some afternoon to a stranger's garden. Did I have to know all this before he could ask such a little thing? He's afraid. He's waited so long. He thought you might be offended. You see, he's a regular tough underneath it all. Something worried me. Why didn't he ask you to arrange a meeting? "He wants her to see his house," she explained, "and your house is right next door." "Oh." "I think he half expected her to wander into one of his parties some night," went on Jordan. "But she never did. Then he began asking people casually if they knew her, and I was the first one he found. It was that night he sent for me at his dance, and you should have heard the elaborate way he worked up to it. Of course, I immediately suggested a luncheon in New York, and I thought he'd go mad. 'I don't want to do anything out of the way,' he kept saying. 'I want to see her right next door.' When I said you were a particular friend of Tom's, he started to abandon the whole idea. He doesn't know very much about Tom, though he says he's read the Chicago paper for years, just on the chance of catching a glimpse of Daisy's name." It was dark now, and as we dipped under a little bridge, I put my arm around Jordan's golden shoulder and drew her toward me and asked her to dinner. Suddenly I wasn't thinking of Daisy and Gatsby any more, but of this clean, hard, limited person who dealt in universal skepticism and who leaned back jauntily just within the circle of my arm. A phrase began to beat in my ears with a sort of heady excitement. There are only the pursued, the pursuing, the busy, and the tired. "And Daisy ought to have something in her life," murmured Jordan to me. "Does she want to see Gatsby?" "She's not to know about it. Gatsby doesn't want her to know. You're just supposed to invite her to tea." We passed a barrier of dark trees, and then the facade of 59th Street. A block of delicate pale light beamed down into the park. Unlike Gatsby and Tom Buchanan, I had no girl whose disembodied face floated along the dark cornices and blinding signs, and so I drew up the girl beside me, tightening my arms. Her wan, scornful mouth smiled, and so I drew her up again, closer, this time to my face. Chapter 5. When I came home to West Egg that night, I was afraid for a moment that my house was on fire. 2 o'clock, and the whole corner of the peninsula was blazing with light, which fell unreal on the shrubbery and made thin, elongating glints upon the roadside wires. Turning a corner, I saw that it was Gatsby's house, lit from tower to cellar. At first I thought it was another party, a wild rout that had resolved itself into hide-and-go-seek or sardines in the box, with all the house thrown open to the game. But there wasn't a sound. Only wind in the trees, which blew the wires and made the lights go off and on again, as if the house had winked into the darkness. As my taxi groaned away, I saw Gatsby walking toward me across his lawn. "Your place looks like a world's fair," I said.
"Does it?"
He turned his eyes toward it absently. "I have been glancing into some of the rooms. Let's go to Coney Island, old sport, in my car."
"It's too late."
"Well, suppose we take a plunge in the swimming pool. I haven't made use of it all summer."
"I've got to go to bed."
"All right." He waited, looking at me with suppressed eagerness. "I talked with Miss Baker," I said after a moment. "I'm going to call up Daisy tomorrow and invite her over here for tea."
"Oh, that's all right," he said carelessly. "I don't want to put you to any trouble."
"What day would suit you?"
"What day would suit you?" he corrected me quickly. "I don't want to put you to any trouble, you see."
"How about the day after tomorrow?"
He considered it for a moment, then, with reluctance, "I want to get the grass cut," he said. We both looked at the grass. There was a sharp line where my ragged lawn ended, and the darker, well-kept expanse of his began. I suspected that he meant my grass. "There's another little thing," he said uncertainly and hesitated. "Would you rather put it off for a few days?" I asked. "Oh, it isn't about that, at least," he fumbled with a series of beginnings. "Why, I thought, why, look here, old sport, you don't make much money, do you?" "Not very much." This seemed to reassure him, and he continued more confidently. "I thought you didn't, if you'll pardon my... You see, I carry on a little business on the side, a sort of sideline, you understand, and I thought that if you don't make very much, you're selling bonds, aren't you, old sport?"
"Trying to."
"Well, this would interest you. It wouldn't take up much of your time, and you might pick up a nice bit of money. It happens to be a rather confidential sort of thing."
I realize now that under different circumstances that conversation might have been one of the crises of my life. But because the offer was obviously and tactlessly for a service to be rendered, I had no choice except to cut him off there. "I've got my hands full," I said. "I'm much obliged, but I couldn't take on any more work." "You wouldn't have to do any business with Wolfsheim." Evidently he thought that I was shying away from the Gonegian mentioned at lunch, but I assured him he was wrong. He waited a moment longer, hoping I'd begin a conversation, but I was too absorbed to be responsive, so he went unwillingly home. The evening made me lightheaded and happy. I think I walked into a deep sleep as I entered my front door. So I didn't know whether or not Gatsby went to Coney Island, or for how many hours he glanced into rooms while his house blazed gaudily on. I called up Daisy from the office the next morning and invited her to come to tea. "Don't bring Tom," I warned her.
"What?"
"Don't bring Tom."
"Who is Tom?" she asked innocently.
The day agreed upon was pouring rain. At 11 o'clock, a man in a raincoat dragging a lawnmower tapped at my front door and said that Mr. Gatsby had sent him over to cut the grass. This reminded me that I had forgotten to tell my Finn to come back, so I drove into West Egg Village to search for her among the soggy, whitewashed alleys and to buy some cups and lemons and flowers. The flowers were unnecessary, for at 2 o'clock a greenhouse arrived from Gatsby's, with innumerable receptacles to contain it. An hour later the front door opened nervously, and Gatsby, in a white flannel suit, silver shirt, and gold-colored tie, hurried in. He was pale, and there were dark signs of sleeplessness beneath his eyes.
"Is everything all right?" he asked immediately.
"The grass looks fine, if that's what you mean."
"What grass?"
he inquired blankly.
"Oh, the grass in the yard."
He looked out the window at it, but judging from his expression, I don't believe he saw a thing.
"Looks very good," he remarked vaguely.
"One of the papers said they thought the rain would stop about 4. I think it was the Journal. Have you got everything you need in the shape of tea?" I took him into the pantry, where he looked a little reproachfully at the Finn. Together we scrutinized the 12 lemon cakes from the delicatessen shop.
"Will they do?"
I asked.
Of course, they're fine."
And he added hollowly, "Old sport?" The rain cooled about 3:30 to a damp mist, through which occasional thin drops swam like dew. Gatsby looked with vacant eyes through a copy of Clay's Economics, starting at the finished tread that shook the kitchen floor, and peering toward the bleared windows from time to time, as if a series of invisible but alarming happenings were taking place outside. Finally he got up and informed me in an uncertain voice that he was going home.
"Why's that?"
"Nobody's coming to tea. It's too late." He looked at his watch as if there was some pressing demand on his time elsewhere. "I can't wait all day."
"Don't be silly. It's just 4:02.
He sat down miserably as if I had pushed him, and simultaneously there was the sound of a motor turning into my lane. We both jumped up, and a little harrowed myself, I went out into the yard. Under the dripping, bare lilac trees, a large, open car was coming up the drive. It stopped. Daisy's face, tipped sideways beneath a three-cornered lavender hat, looked out at me with a bright, ecstatic smile. "Is this absolutely where you live, my dearest one?" The exhilarating ripple of her voice was a wild tonic in the rain. I had to follow the sound of it for a moment, up and down, with my ear alone, before any words came through. A damp streak of hair lay like a dash of blue paint across her cheek, and her hand was wet with glistening drops as I took it to help her from the car. "Are you in love with me?" she said low in my ear. "Or why did I have to come alone?" "That's the secret of Castle Rack Rent. Tell your chauffeur to go far away and spend an hour. Come back in an hour, Ferdy." Then in a grave murmur, "His name is Ferdy." "Does the gasoline affect his nose?" "I don't think so," she said innocently. "Why?" We went in. To my overwhelming surprise, the living room was deserted. "Well, that's funny," I exclaimed. "What's funny?" She turned her head as there was a light, dignified knocking at the front door. I went out and opened it. Gatsby, pale as death, with his hands plunged like weights in his coat pockets, was standing in a puddle of water, glaring tragically into my eyes. With his hands still in his coat pockets, he stalked by me into the hall, turned sharply as if we were on a wire, and disappeared into the living room. It wasn't a bit funny. Aware of the loud beating of my own heart, I pulled the door against the increasing rain. For half a minute there wasn't a sound. Then from the living room I heard a sort of choking murmur and part of a laugh, followed by Daisy's voice on a clear, artificial note. "I certainly am awfully glad to see you again." A pause. It endured horribly. I had nothing to do in the hall, so I went into the room. Gatsby, his hands still in his pockets, was reclining against the mantelpiece in a strained counterfeit of perfect ease, even of boredom. His head leaned back so far that it rested against the face of a defunct mantelpiece clock, and from this position his distraught eyes stared down at Daisy, who was sitting, frightened but graceful, on the edge of a stiff chair. "We've met before," muttered Gatsby. His eyes glanced momentarily at me, and his lips parted with an abortive attempt at a laugh. Luckily, the clock took this moment to tilt dangerously at the pressure of his head, whereupon he turned and caught it with trembling fingers, and set it back in place. Then he sat down, rigidly, his elbow on the arm of the sofa and his chin in his hand. "I'm sorry about the clock," he said. My own face had now assumed a deep, tropical burn. I couldn't muster up a single commonplace out of the thousand in my head. "It's an old clock," I told them idiotically. I think we all behaved for a moment that it had smashed in pieces on the floor. "We haven't met for many years," said Daisy, her voice as matter-of-fact as it could be.
5 years next November."
The automatic quality of Gatsby's answer set us all back at least another minute. I had them both on their feet with the desperate suggestion that they help me make tea in the kitchen when the demoniac Finn brought it in on a tray. Amid the welcome confusion of cups and cakes, a certain physical decency established itself. Gatsby got himself into a shadow and, while Daisy and I talked, looked conscientiously from one to the other of us with tense, unhappy eyes. However, as calmness wasn't an end in itself, I made an excuse at the first possible moment and got to my feet.
"Where are you going?"
demanded Gatsby in immediate alarm.
"I'll be back. I've got to speak with you about something before you go."
He followed me wildly into the kitchen, closed the door, and whispered, "Oh, God," in a miserable way.
"What's the matter?"
"This is a terrible mistake," he said, shaking his head from side to side.
"A terrible, terrible mistake."
"You're just embarrassed, that's all." And luckily, I added, "Daisy's embarrassed, too."
"She's embarrassed?"
he repeated incredulously.
"Just as much as you are. Don't talk so loud."
"You're acting like a little boy," I broke out impatiently. "Not only that, but you're rude. Daisy's sitting in there all alone." He raised his hand to stop my words, looked at me with unforgettable reproach, and, opening the door cautiously, went back into the room. I walked out the back way,
just as Gatsby had when he had made his nervous circuit of the house half an hour before. I ran for a huge black-knotted tree, whose massed leaves made a fabric against the rain. Once more it was pouring, and my irregular lawn, well shaved by Gatsby's gardener, abounded in small muddy swamps and prehistoric marshes. There was nothing to look at from under the tree except Gatsby's enormous house, so I stared at it, like Kant at his church steeple, for half an hour. A brewer had built it early in the period craze, a decade before, and there was a story that he'd agreed to pay 5 years' taxes on all the neighboring cottages if the owners would have their roofs thatched with straw. Perhaps their refusal took the heart out of his plan to found a family. He went into immediate decline. His children sold his house with the black wreath still on the door. Americans, while occasionally willing to be serfs, have always been obstinate about being peasantry. After half an hour, the sun shone again, and the grocer's automobile rounded Gatsby's drive with new raw material for his servant's dinner. I felt sure he wouldn't eat a spoonful. A maid began opening the upper windows of his house, appeared momentarily in each, and, leaning from a large central bay, spat meditatively into the ground. It was time I went back. While the rain continued, it had seemed like the murmur of their voices rising and swelling a little now and then, with gusts of emotion. But in the new silence, I felt that silence had fallen within the house, too. I went in, after making every possible noise in the kitchen, short of pushing over the stove. But I don't believe they heard a sound. They were sitting at either end of the couch, looking at each other as if some question had been asked, or was in the air, and every vestige of embarrassment was gone. Daisy's face was smeared with tears, and when I came in she jumped up and began wiping at it with her handkerchief before a mirror. But there was a change in Gatsby that was simply confounding. He literally glowed. Without a word or a gesture of exultation, a new well-being radiated from him and filled the little room. "Oh, hello, old sport," he said, as if he hadn't seen me for years. I thought for a moment he was going to shake hands. It stopped raining. "Has it?" When he realized what I was talking about, that there were twinkle bells of sunshine in the room, he smiled like a weatherman, like an ecstatic patron of recurrent light, and repeated the news to Daisy. "What do you think of that? It stopped raining." "I'm glad, Jay." Her throat, full of aching, grieving beauty, told only of her unexpected joy. "I want you and Daisy to come over to my house," he said. "I'd like to show her around." "You sure you want me to come?" "Absolutely, old sport." Daisy went upstairs to wash her face. Too late, I thought, with humiliation of my towels, while Gatsby and I waited on the lawn. "My house looks well, doesn't it?" he demanded. "See how the whole front of it catches the light?" I agreed that it was splendid. "Yes," his eyes went over it, every arched door and square tower. "It took me just 3 years to earn the money that bought it." "I thought you inherited the money." "I did, old sport," he said automatically. "But I lost most of it in the big panic, the panic of the war." I think he hardly knew what he was saying, for when I asked him what business he was in, he answered, "That's my affair," before he realized that it wasn't the appropriate reply. "Oh, I've been in several things," he corrected himself. "I was in the drug business, and then I was in the oil business, but I'm not in either one now." He looked at me with more attention. "Do you mean you've been thinking over what I proposed the other night?" Before I could answer, Daisy came out of the house, and two rows of brass buttons on her dress gleamed in the sunlight. "That huge place there?" she cried, pointing. "Do you like it?" "I love it, but I don't see how you live there all alone." "I keep it always full of interesting people, night and day, people who do interesting things, celebrated people." Instead of taking the shortcut along the sound, we went down the road and entered by the big postern. With enchanting murmurs, Daisy admired this aspect or that of the feudal silhouette against the sky, admired the gardens, the sparkling odor of jonquils, and the frothy odor of hawthorn and plum blossoms, and the pale gold odor of kiss me at the gate. It was strange to reach the marble steps and find no stir of bright dresses in and out of the door, and hear no sound but bird voices in the trees. And inside, As we wandered through Marie Antoinette music rooms and restoration salons, I felt that there were guests concealed behind every couch and table, under orders to be breathlessly silent until we had passed through. As Gatsby closed the door of the Merton College Library, I could have sworn I heard the owl-eyed man break into a ghostly laughter. We went upstairs, through period bedrooms swathed in rose and lavender silk and vivid with new flowers, through dressing rooms and pool rooms, and bathrooms with sunken baths, intruding into one chamber where a disheveled man in pajamas was doing liver exercises on the floor. It was Mr. Klipspringer, the boarder. I had seen him wandering hungrily about the beach that morning. Finally, we came to Gatsby's own apartment, a bedroom and a bath, and an Adam study, where we sat down and drank a glass of some chartreuse he took from a cupboard in the wall. He hadn't once ceased looking at Daisy, and I think he revalued everything in his house according to the measure of response it drew from her well-loved eyes. Sometimes, too, he stared around at his possessions in a dazed way, as though in her actual and astounding presence none of it was any longer real. Once he nearly toppled down a flight of stairs.
That's all the time we have for this episode of The Bookshelf. You've been listening to Tom Lee's reading of The Great Gatsby by F. Scott Fitzgerald. If you miss an episode of this book or want to listen again, you can find past episodes of The Bookshelf at SpokanePublicRadio.org or by subscribing to The Bookshelf podcast. For Spokane Public Radio, I'm Chris Messini.